Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. Then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me. And walk this lovely
Kirk, you hear what the Pope's up to these days?
Well, the only thing I know is he pulls his ring away a lot if you try to kiss it. Did you see, that video?
The first time ever he started to do that. I think he's just repulsed by a germaphobe. Probably has OCD. And he later commented, yeah, I just didn't want the spread of germs. But he says, you know, in private ceremonies, if people want to kiss my papal ring, I will graciously allow it.
Well,
what do you think Yahweh was going to do with that boy with his papal ring?
Yeah.
The reason I actually mentioned it is he's planning a trip to Morocco. You know, he's had a really busy week. You know, after it was discovered that there's three or four more countries down there announcing that they have thousands of Catholic boys that were abused by Catholic priests. He passed new legislation, new church canon law on priestly pedophilia. Now, can you imagine being a religious organization and having to pass laws and say, you know, you shouldn't screw little boys?
Should be obvious.
No. I mean, you just gotta laugh. I mean, how is it that you could claim to be an institution representing God, and you have to pass laws on those screw little boys? Well, the other thing he's doing, he is headed to Morocco, and the trip is trying to deflect attention, of course, for all the bad press he's getting on priestly pedophilia. He is going to try to expand on what he did with the Imam of Cairo's Al-Azhar University, which is the seat of Islamic terrorism worldwide. There, they passed a joint and signed landmark statement establishing the relationship between Catholics and Muslims as brothers with a common mission to promote peace.
Really?
Well, you know, they do share something in common. They do share something in common, which does make them brothers.
Hate to see you go there.
They worship the same God.
Yeah, that's true. That's
the Lord of Roman Catholicism and Allah of Islam are the same wannabe God known to the world as Satan. As Satan. So they've got that in common, and I guess that'll work out for them.
You
did a little study because you found it interesting how everything God had to say about Esau pointed to either Imperial Rome or to the Roman Catholic Church.
Right.
Well, really, basically one and the same, one ground or the other. And then you thought it might be fun to check in to see if Esau wives' names might also elucidate that discussion. And what you found is that while Jacob chose well, Esau didn't choose so well, did he?
No, sir. Not at all. He violated
did what the number one thing Yahweh said don't do. He married what tribe of people?
A Canaanite, or two Canaanites, actually.
Yeah, two of the three wives were Canaanites, weren't they?
Yes, sir.
What was the first wife's name?
Well, in the order in 36 is Adah. She was the daughter of Haran. And then the second one was...
What's Adah mean?
Adah, well, she was a... she was an incense user or perfume. So, but it was in the sense of using it as a fragrance in worship of Baal.
So she, her name speaks of burning incense to Baal.
Yes, she was. Well, yeah,
so burning incense to the Lord. Is there any religious organization that is that you were to walk into one of their sanctuaries and you would be overwhelmed with burning incense?
Yeah, try Rome. If you go through there, as I did one time.
The Roman Catholic Church, right?
Everywhere.
Most of the sanctuaries, you walk through, there's a little statue to Mary, and they've got all sorts of little relics all around to their saints, and they burn incense to them, don't they?
Oh, yes.
So burning incense to the Lord, that would be an indication that he married a forebearer to Roman Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh has a lot to say, by the way, about burning incense to Baal, and none of it's good.
No.
What was the second wife's name?
Ola or Ohole Bama, and she was.
Oh, that doesn't sound good.
Well, no.
Because Ohel means tent, and it's used and the tabernacle, so this would be tabernacle tent, temple.
Yes.
And the rest of it is open to the public, right?
Yes. And it was normally in pagan temples, they would usually have temple prostitutes, and that was her rap as well. So,
being in a temple that was open to the public, she's likely a temple prostitute.
That would be the implication. At least that would be the meaning. Well, what she did is can't prove, but it's implied.
No, it's interesting. Now he had a trinity of wives, didn't he?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, one Jew, two Gentiles, kind of like the trinity of Christianity. What was the third wife?
Third wife was Basemath or Basemath. And of course, she was the daughter of Ishmael. So he actually married into the family of Abraham, although it was not the chosen family.
Why do you think, you know, God doesn't actually say he hates that Ishmael, he just said you're excluded from the covenant, which would be Islam.
Yes.
Why do you think God says that he hates Esau? I mean, that's pretty strong words. I don't know if anybody else he comes out and says, there's things he hates. You know, he hates religion. He hates government and militarism and bloodletting and violence and twisting and perverting his testimony. A lot of things that he hates. But I'm not familiar with any other person called out by name that just, because even Paul, which he says he's the plague of death. I think Paul's too despicable to hate. But Esau says, I hate him.
Yeah, he said, like from the time he was in the womb, he hated him.
Yeah.
Is it symbolic in the sense that, you know, he knows where this is going? I mean, he obviously saw it coming. But he's just, everything about him seems to be opposed to the Torah, opposed to
would
the
it,
Mitzvah.
Would it be consistent with Yahweh's style to say that he hated a man, even though he married Ishmael's daughter and a couple of Canaanites. hunter and then violence and, you know, killing life is not the idea of a good time. But what Esau himself, if he just represented a lone individual, would he garner the kind of animosity for God to tell us, I hate that guy?
Well, only in the sense that I view it as these are all teaching tools. You know, this is Yahweh trying to teach us. So it doesn't surprise me that he does it. I just, boy, it's heavy duty, though. You have to admit that.
Well, I don't think, what I was driving at here, I think only if it's a teaching tool, because Esau represents the last two beasts, the single most vicious beast in human history, Imperial Rome, and the one beast that grew out of Imperial Rome that treads upon the whole world, Roman Catholicism, it would be appropriate for Yahweh to tell us he hates Imperial Rome. No one bludgeoned his children more viciously. Or Roman Catholicism, no one bludgeoned his children longer. And so I think it would be appropriate to say, I hate those things. Yeah, I would have every reason to say that.
Yeah. So, yes. I agree.
I want to turn to, thank you, Kirk, for doing that. I want to turn to back to Jeremiah 51. Just by way of background. We turn to Jeremiah 51:51, and we're going to go through to probably 7 or 8 statements here in Jeremiah. Because we were trying to figure out what Laom was. Now, it's Laom that led us to understanding what Esau represents, because Laom is used twice in the Torah relative to the nation that grew out of both Esau and Jacob. But we were using it because, as Yahweh was telling us what he was going to do and who the people were that were going to feel the sting of destruction and death in the last days, there was Laom, and Laom is such an unusual word. I think it's only used 20 times. That we decided we would just figure out precisely what it means. And here in Jeremiah 51, that's what we find. And as I was translating this, we're going to go through Isaiah 5, 6, 7 passages of it. I was so enthralled by Jeremiah's parallel account of what we've been reading in Yeshayah 17 that I went back and I said, you know, where do I need to pick this up? I think I want to do a whole chapter on Jeremiah 51. And I started reading backwards. I got all the way to 48 before I found a place that I could actually start, where it where I wasn't going back beyond the story we were telling Yahshayah at 48. It's the demise of Moab. And so, and it's the divide. And if you look at the Yahshayah 17, well, the two chapters that preceded 15 and 16. Are devoted entirely to Moab and the fall of Moab. So as I started saying, well, okay, that's the right place to start. I'll start in Jeremiah 48. But then I realized, you know, for Moab to get a chapter or so of Jeremiah and two whole chapters of Yahshayah speaking of end times prophecy, we really got to nail down and figure out what Moab represents and prove the conclusion that I had that Moab ceased to exist as a nation at the time both Jeremiah and Yahshayah wrote, which was, you know, right around 700 BCE. And so I went back 3 chapters earlier, which was the chapter on Yahshayah 15 and 16, which is now entitled Where the Voice of the Torah Died. And I decided, you know, the smart thing to do here is, rather than me say, all right, if I read these independent historical accounts, Moab, really the last we know of Moab is just shortly after the Mishnah steal, where King Mishnah is bragging he did this, that, and the other to Israel. report two things.
Okay.
One is that there is no question whatsoever. Moab ceased to exist as a kingdom 150 years before Yahshayah and Yirmiyah were speaking of their fall in their prophetic testimony. Now, if they had fallen 150 years as a kingdom prior to Yirmiyah and Yahshayah speaking of them and devoting all of that energy to them and time and words to them, what does that tell you?
Well, it has to be symbolic because they're gone.
Correct. It has to be symbolic. So now, since it has to be symbolic, it's incumbent upon us to figure out who he's speaking of. What does Moab represent today? And so that was the first thing to find. And the second was, as I was going through, you know, these are not what you consider the prophetic books. This is not the really juicy stuff that just usually causes your skin to tingle when you find stuff. I'm translating Second Kings here, you know, Chronicles.
Yeah,
that's what the story is told here of Moab, is Chronicles and Kings. Mm-hmm. And there are stories in them, and the presentation, for example, of the fall of Moab with the prophet Elisha, that just makes you want to giggle and scream and stamp your feet, and it's really, really good stuff. And the attitude that God allows in those who speak for him just tickles me no end. You know, and the sense of humor, we love a good time as we go through them. So I can tell you for certain that when we talk about Moab and we talk about the same thing would be true with Edom, which is the descendants of Esau. That's why it's important to figure out who he represents just as many other communities like the Philistine. The Philistines are also destroyed in the end.
Yes.
Babylon's destroyed in the end. So Babylon falls, the Philistines fall, Moab falls, Edom falls. And so all of those represent a unique entity, institution, nation, people. In the last days, it was like when we were trying to figure out who the ships of Tarshish were.
Yes.
And then the connection between Tarshish and Carthage.
Carthaginian.
And then we find that, well, Carthage is like a early version of the United States in almost in every possible way. Carthage is even closer to the United States than the country that destroyed them. And,
yeah.
We are
their
really
foreign Roman policy was the same. The way they captured
yes.
and conquered and occupied,
yeah.
they did the same thing the British did that the Americans took over and did worldwide.
Right.
You know?
Control the ports. Control the oceans. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the Carthaginians were the first to control currency.
Mm-hmm.
They had the reserve currency of the ancient world. They controlled trade, which is what America does. That's how it's positioned itself around the world. All right, so with that background, we're going to spend a lot of time in Yirmiyah 51 and going back to tell this story. Let's start in Yirmiyah 51:51 because that's going to lead us to an understanding of what Leom represents. But even more importantly, you know how in one of the most famed passages in Revelation is, I think it's 18. Babylon has fallen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I've made the claim lots of times that Yosha didn't say anything that wasn't written in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms.
Mm-hmm.
Guess
found
what?
It, huh?
You found it. Yeah. After a great passage of time, this opening statement is just so powerful. After a great passage of time, we are humiliated and ashamed, despairing for finally having come to realize that we have been wrong. For we have come to hear contemptible defiance, vile insult, and scorn. Being openly and publicly shamed, along with the confusing insults, have come to clothe our presence just as we have kept vital information from others helped establish our authority. Because now, foreigners, those deemed illegitimate, who are unauthorized, have arrived upon the set-apart place of the home of Yahweh. Christians will tell you that this is the Babylonian attack on Jerusalem.
No way.
But it can't be.
No, it's long.
And it can't be because Yehudim, at that time,
that way,
and still to this day, have not come to this conclusion.
That's right. Exactly.
I mean, there were periods of times where there were individuals in Yehuda. Over the last 2,700 years, there are individuals who have come to this conclusion.
Right.
But as a nation, not even close.
Not yet. No.
Therefore, this prophecy is addressing the same time, people, and war.
Place and time.
Yeah, depicted in Yeshaya 17, when foreigners will flood into Israel and lay claim to the set-apart place of Yahweh's name. This couldn't even speak of the Roman assaults.
That's true.
Because Israel didn't come to that conclusion then, either, did they?
No, they went to war with them, thinking they could solve the problem.
Yeah. Most certainly couldn't be during the Byzantine attacks, or the Crusaders, or the Islamic.
Weren't there.
Because there were dwindling numbers of Jews, and they didn't come to this conclusion.
No.
So after a great passage of time, you know, Jeremiah is writing in right around high 600s BCE. You know, we don't have a great passage of time before the Babylonian assault, but we sure as heck do today.
Yes, indeed.
And finally, they're humiliated and ashamed, despairing for finally having come to realize that we have been wrong. At long last, this is Bosch, we are confounded and confused. Now that the appropriate amount of time has passed, we recognize that we are shameful and disgraced, even disappointed and disconcerted. For we have come to hear and have listened to contemptible defiance, vile insults, and scorn, being taunted with shameful slurs, being reproached and dishonored as if disobeying a lowly status, deserving a lowly status. You know, the people who slur Yahweh, Yehuda, Israel, Zion the most are Muslims.
Well, yes.
Being openly and publicly ashamed, along with confusing insults, disgracefully and confounding name-calling. Who are the people that call Israel by names? They call, you know, the Quran calls Jews apes and swine, apes and pigs. Allah says that he made Jewish faces look like their asses. That's a classic God.
Got
extra bonus points for killing Jews. And Allahu Akbar is probably the most contemptible, defiant, shameful, confusing insult of all time. Because it's errantly rendered, God is great.
Yeah.
What it either means, Allah is a mouse, or Allah wants to be considered greater than Yahweh.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, the greater, wiser, better. Yeah. All the better.
Or mousy. We have come to clothe our presence just as we have kept vital information from others to establish our authority. We have hidden and concealed our true nature based on how we have adorned ourselves, precluding an informed response by our appearance. You know what the rabbis say of Gentiles? They say that we don't have an Osama. So, it is for darn sure that rabbinical Judaism understands that the difference between Adam and all other humans outside the garden was an Osama. But they make Adam, in rabbinical Judaism, Jewish.
Okay. Give us a great shot, whatever.
Yeah, so we got the Tribes of Adam.
The Tribes of Adam, okay.
Via Noah, I guess.
Yeah, I guess.
Oh, well. So if you cherry pick and pull things together and take things out of context, I guess you can prove anything. But there you have it. That's Rabbinic Judaism. Because foreigners, those deemed illegitimate who are unauthorized, have arrived upon the set-apart place of the home of Yahweh. Boy, have Muslims ever inundated that place. I was telling a friend the other day, you know, I really have no interest in going back to Israel. I don't want to see it again until God cleans house. It's just so rife with religious dress-up. You know, you got three religions, and all of them are playing religious dress-up. I don't know what I think.
But you don't do well with that, you know.
You know, I don't do well with that. God doesn't either, so I'm in good company.
He doesn't either, so you're
watching the little minions of the black hat, fundamentalist, wacko, Jewish religious types, playing religion all day, and in their little black suits and black hats, and they're so feminine. They're so, just nauseatingly non-masculine.
Mm-hmm.
Bobbing up and down. If you're not going to be masculine, it's really good to be feminine. But if you're going to be feminine, it's really better to be a woman. But these girly dudes with their little religious outfits bobbing up and down, reciting religious prayers as if they were somehow earning brownie points. I think that's even worse than watching the woman, you know, walk around in her tent.
Yeah.
So, the realization here is that Yirmiyah is depicting what finally has to happen to Israel. You know, when the Muslims flood into Israel and lay claim to the set-apart place of Yahweh's name, somewhere along the way, that's going to realization and then the subsequent pronouncement is going to happen publicly and privately. Israel is going to acknowledge that they've been wrong about Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, Yahweh has yet to hold Babylon's inspiration of the religions that have grown out of it accountable. The religious invocations of Babel of creating confusion by commingling myths is still reigning supreme. In a world where lies are accepted as truth and truth is considered hateful, Babylon is yet to fall. And that ought really have given us a clue as to Moab, shouldn't it? If Babylon, that kingdom which ceased to exist over 2,000 years ago,
right?
Even the town of Babylon, even the remnants of it, were gone over 2,000 years ago. With Babylon long gone, and yet we're told in Revelation and here in Yirmiyah that Babylon is going to fall in the last days, it's obvious that Babylon represents something.
Right.
Just as does Moab. So, commingling these religions of Babel, the confusion of the Talmud, the confused nature of the Quran, the confusing nature of Pauline, the New Testament, these things have yet to be held accountable, and they will be. It goes on to say, therefore, behold, the days are coming, prophetically declares Yahweh, when I will account for her religious images and objects of worship. And throughout all her land, the defiled and reprehensible shall groan in anguish. The reason this is important is that I think outside of the Berith Fellowship that we have formed here by studying Yaz Torah, most people are very uncomfortable applying the Babylonian tag to religion. They can't imagine that it's religion that God is so upset with. I mean, it's the antithesis of what they've been led to believe. Mm-hmm. But what does this say? Behold, the days are coming, prophetically declares Yahweh, when I will account for, when I will choose to execute judgment and ascribe an appropriate penalty based upon a thorough inspection and assessment. And I'm going to assign responsibility for this offensive violation of her religious images and objects of worship, Pakal, her representations of her God, including carved and cast, holy, sanctioned, hallowed, and blessed divine depictions, her idols, fashioned of wood, of metal, of stone, any of which elicit devotion, such as a cross, a crucifix, ornate religious buildings, churches, temples, which house them. This is like the second statement that he has in his own. He says, don't be associated with any religious imagery or any religious environment.
Yeah. Don't carve it. Don't make it. Don't bow down to
right.
it. Don't represent it.
Right. So this is an absolute, unequivocal affirmation that what Babel represents that Yahweh is going to hold accountable is all the trimmings of religion.
Correct.
And when Yahweh wipes out all trimmings of religion, it's going to be a tough day in her land. And people are going to groan in anguish. Now, one of the reasons it says that in their land, because now we're talking about the land of Iraq, Iran, you know, and Syria and the like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Yahweh wipes out the invading horde of Islamic terrorists that are flooding into Israel, you know, guess where they're going to come from?
Well, a lot of them are going to come from right there. Yeah, Iraq and Iran.
Yep. So that's why they're going to be moaning in anguish.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Yahweh is a proponent, as we know, of clarity, his source of answers. So should anyone have been confused, wondering why an empire which reigned briefly and which has been extinct as an empire for 2,500 years would play such a prominent role in the prophecies which play out during the last days of Jacob's troubles, this is the answer. Yahweh is going to account for Babel's Pekel, religious images and objects of worship. Babel's representations of her gods.
Yeah.
All of her hallowed and holy works of art, along with the ornate buildings, which put them on display and encourage devotion. And when we study the evolution of religion from Babylon through Persia, Greece, and Rome, we find that Christianity is the most rife with those myths. Almost every important aspect of the Christian religion has Babylonian roots, from its Lord being called God to the Son of God, from its Trinity to its dying and resurrected deity, from its Easter and Christmas celebrations to its Sunday worship, from its Madonna and Child to its crosses and steeples.
Well, you just mentioned he's clear. He's clear. That's exactly what. How can you mistranslate Pekel from Pekel, which is, you know, chiseled stone? I mean, is. How much?
Yeah, what do you think they were chiseling? That God was going to hold accountable. Do you think they're chiseling raccoons and flying squirrels?
Yeah, I mean. What do they think?
Are they chiseling palm trees and toadstools?
No.
I mean, what do you think they're chiseling?
Well, Michelangelo did some pretty obvious ones. You know, everything wrong.
But even if you look at Michelangelo,
yeah.
You know, he's chiseling David as a Gentile.
Yes, uncircumcised. Yeah.
Yeah. Like he's Roman, and he's completely out of proportion.
He does the Madonna, he does the Astarte, and on and on.
Right, painting the Last Supper. There's no Last Supper. You know, it's... It shouldn't be difficult. And yet, you know, for better part of several hundred years, the Roman Catholic Church knew dead right when it comes to graved images, because they had idols and images, carved images, you know, everywhere. That their whole mystique is to have these religious images everywhere. So what they did, because everybody knew there were 10 commandments, and one of them is just so destructive of them, they broke another one in two. I think it was the one on coveting. They made that two commandments. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, and thou shalt not cover thy neighbor's house. And they just eliminated the graven images.
What was it? Don't change the jot or tittle? Wow, that's a big jot and tittle.
Oh, my. I mean, it's just indicative of the fact that they know they're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't care.
Yeah.
Though Babylon, creating confusion by commingling and combining to confound. Babel, Bible, Babylonia, the Roman Catholic Church, and by the way, the influence of Christianity, America, Europe, means to promote and encourage mistaken misconceptions through mixing, muddling, and blending together, and therefore would also include Islam, multiculturalism.
Mm-hmm.
I know geographically it'd be Mesopotamia, Iraq, Iran. It's from Baal, to mix, mingle, confuse, and confound in association with the Lord, Baal, and to offer the resulting concoctions as if they were nourishing. So though Babylon should lift herself up toward heaven, and though she should seek to make inaccessible to attack her source of religious power and political strength in high places, devastating destruction, annihilation, and obliteration will come from me against her, prophetically declares Yahweh. Now, for all those little Christian theologians out there that say this is not speaking of mystery Babylon and this is not the source of our Lord's revelation, this is speaking about the fall of ancient Babylon. Did the ancient Babylon fall as a result of an action of Yahweh?
No. I think the Assyrians wiped
them. No, the Persians conquered them.
Persians.
And it most certainly wasn't I could call it Media Persia. Media, I think, is thrown into the mix just to give us a little flavor for. Mm-hmm. Or where these people came from, but you know, the Midians were essentially a little fiefdom carved out of Assyrian Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
But Yahweh didn't obliterate him, did he?
No, he didn't.
No.
And every historian knows it. So what's the so
right? Right. God doesn't take credit for what God doesn't do.
Right.
And He actually told us how they were going to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that Babylon as a city continued to endure past that. It's just that uprising essentially ended its control as an empire. And boy, they were a flash in the pan. They didn't exist very long.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the influence of these people God's talking about. So though Babylon creating confusion by combining and commingling to confound, should lift herself up to heaven, should ascend to the spiritual realm, adorning herself and acquiring conscripts in heaven's name. Should she be lifted up and exalted spiritually, like Allah? Should she be carried away with herself and ascribed a lofty status, like the Roman Catholic Church?
Mm-hmm.
And though she should seek to make inaccessible to attack, she should try to fortify her position to thwart a successful solution, making an attack on her implausible, constantly seeking to buttress and defend herself, cutting herself off spiritually while keeping her mysteries inaccessible and secret. This is the nature of religion.
Yeah, it's no place to hide.
They do everything they can to make themselves impervious to attack.
Yeah.
Well, you should try sometime to debate a Mormon. Or a Roman Catholic, doesn't matter. The Roman Catholic would just assume that their church was established by God, and therefore their church is divine, and anybody who would speak against their church is therefore satanic.
Well, that
going to hell.
God.
And if you try to awaken a Muslim and say, you know, every significant assumption in the Book of Mormon is false. And let's just go through them one at a time. And they say, oh, well, you're just a critic, and you know, critics criticize. And so the same thing with the Catholic. They just demean the source and don't bother with the argument.
Mm-hmm.
They've found a way to make themselves impervious to attack. And yet they've done everything they can to set themselves up as the gatekeepers of the spiritual realm. There was an announcement today. I don't know if you read it, but the an old fart. I think he's 80-something years old. That's the president of the Church of Latter-day Saints. And he says that he's been having lots of conversations with his Lord recently. And his Lord comes to him in the darkness of night. And his Lord, a few weeks ago, told him that he didn't want to use the name Mormon anymore. And so he told the faithful, you're not Mormons, and we're not going to use the name Mormon anymore. The Lord, he told me, I just want to use Latter-day Saints.
Okay.
Let me tell you something. He's right. The Lord is speaking to him more and more every day.
Yeah.
Too bad he doesn't know who the Lord is. So, this attack that Yahweh was speaking of against the religions born and bred in Babylon, specifically Christianity and Islam, and actually you could say Judaism too, because the Talmud is the Babylonian Talmud after all. Islam was created just outside of Babylon. That's where it was first codified. The first written Quran was written just outside of Babylon. All of the Sunnah was conceived there. That's where it's compiled. Ibn Ishaq's book written just outside of Babylon. Tabari's history written just outside of Babylon. So, that, and of course, Christianity, we just talked about almost every aspect of Christianity is Babylonian, including the Bible. They've not been directly pursued by Yahweh. They haven't been destroyed, annihilated, or obliterated by him. But all of these false gods, these false religious texts, these holy edifices, the pastors, the imams, the beguiled believers, combined will be no match for the Almighty. And Yahweh's going to return and camp out in Israel with his children. And pestilence, which is religion, has to be eradicated for this to be the case. So it shall be.
Mm-hmm.
Religious institutions which have claimed to be inspired and authorized by God will actually be obliterated by God.
Good.
Yep. Now, it should be noted that just as Babel is a compound of Ba and Bel, the Lord with the Lord, Betzar, which is the concluding statement here, is a compound of Ba and Tsar. Now, Tsar is really an interesting word because of where it is used. Notice it says, though he should seek to make inaccessible to attack the Tsar. Tsar is the word when Yahweh says the time of Jacob's troubles.
Mm-hmm.
It's Jacob's Tsar.
Uh-huh.
And Tsar means narrow and confined in dire straits. What did Yahweh say in Yeshayah 17 is going to happen to Israel?
They're going to be shrunk at the waist, of course.
Right. Narrow and confined in dire straits. Right.
Most definitely. Yeah.
Greatly distressed by the adversary and oppressed by enemy forces. So this is, in other words, the time of Jacob's troubles, Tsar, Mm-hmm. And the depiction that Yahweh provides of Yisrael's last days in Yeshaya 17 are perfectly matched.
Mm-hmm.
That Yisrael's going to be sar, caged in and besieged, vexed and harassed, feeling the sharp edge of the flint used to kindle a fire, kindle a reaction, and the knife to cut and kill. Now, here's something that we'll share, and I think you'll hear echoes of Revelation. The sound of the accusation and outcry from and against Babylon, and the crippling destruction and crushing downfall will be extraordinary and surprisingly great because of what has come out of the realm of the Kashti, the Chaldeans, and their theologians.
Babylon has fallen.
Babylon has fallen. And that fall is going to be extraordinarily great because of what has come out of the land of the Kashti, the Chaldeans and their theologians, the land of the people between the Euphrates and Tigris rivers, bordering on the Persian Gulf, used interchangeably with Babylon. Kashti means religious slaves, sages, fortune tellers, magicians, dream interpreters, and astrologers. Babylon has fallen in an extraordinary and surprising way. At long last, Babylon, the confusing nature of the Christian Bible, the horror of Babylon, the Roman Catholic Church, and the religion of Satan is conceived by intermixing truth and lies to confuse and confound, such as Christianity and Islam, along with the nations inspired by the legacy of the Kashti, theologians and religious sages, the astrologers, particularly Western Europe and the United States, have fallen. The influence of the Babylonian religion that has permeated Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, and the politics of her sages, inspiring the likes of multiculturalism and political correctness, even socialist secular humanism, will suffer a catastrophic downfall, experiencing complete destruction and total obliteration at the hands of the Almighty. You know, there's a lot going on these last days. Normally, Yahweh doesn't get involved in doing the deed himself.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually, you know, Gideon, grab some torches and some shofars and make a racket and jump up and down and they'll all run away. Yeah, that's kind of more style. There are so many people to wipe out, to prepare the earth to be reestablished as the Garden of Eden. Then Yahweh was saying, yeah, this would be unfair for me to ask anyone else. No one else can do this. I'll take care of this. I think it'll be painless for most of these people, but he's going to wipe out and exterminate these things. Or indeed, Yahweh is destroying and obliterating, therefore, Babel. Is wiping out and exterminating accordingly her extensively loud voice. Yirmiyah 51:55.
Yeah.
So, for those that might say, we're talking about Babylon being a country. Babylon as a country didn't have much of a voice. Had a hell of an army.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Suppose they had a really pretty city.
Yeah, with the towers and whatever.
Right. But in terms of voice, heck, they were still writing on clay tablets, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. This is,
what kind of a text do we have from Babylon? The code of Hammurabi.
Hammurabi's code, that's about it.
Yeah, that was way, way, way earlier in this period.
Yeah. So not much.
And that's not a voice. Or excessively loud voice.
The world.
Right. Is the loud voice of Allahu Akbar. It's of
the Pope
Christians and onward Christian soldiers.
Yeah.
Well, it's It's the screams of the religious. It's the carols of the religious. It's the evangelists of the religious. It's the televangelists. But he's not talking about the country here. It's the voice, the magnitude, intensity, extent, the vociferous nature of her auditory message, which is given high status by a consensus of others and is deemed distinguished and important by men. You know, the Pope pulls his ring back and makes the front page of every story and every newspaper in the country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I pulled my hand back probably 50 times today.
Asher wouldn't bite it.
Almost every time. Yeah, my little puppy. So once again, we have another affirmation that it isn't the ancient kingdom of Babylon. That's not what's being destroyed or silenced, but instead the voice of Babel, confusion. For Yahweh to reestablish Eden during Sukkah on our behalf, the message still reverberating from Babylon, its religion must be extinguished. Now, especially telling in this regard, Babel, confusion derived from commingling, is not only the basis of Bible, as we have previously and repeatedly affirmed, it is a compound of Ba, with, and Bel, the Lord. Believing that they were worshiping God, religious Christians, Jews, and Muslims alike have been bowing down before Satan. If only they had read and considered Yahweh's prophecies, especially those written on behalf of the Gentiles like Jeremiah, they might have avoided falling prey to the adversary. Now, in Yeshaya 17, we hear about the gall, the surging waves, the hum of the loud groaning, and the enraged Rabbim Maim, extensive floodwaters. And we learn how the Sheol, horrible, destructive, and deadly, corrupting and confusing, uproarious and presumptuous influence of Shaul for those who are headed to Sheol. All those words still resonate within us.
Sure.
Well, guess what? They're all used in Jeremiah 51, 55. That ought to tell us we're speaking of the same time, same events. It reads, and they're surging waves. They're loudly groaning from being confused and enraged. Will be similar to a great many extensive and numerous floodwaters, producing a horribly destructive and deadly audible message. So Babylon is the context of Babylon falling,
right?
And all the religious imagery of Babylon being destroyed, and Babylon's voice finally being silenced. And now, contemporaneous with the surging of Muslims into Israel and the loud, groaning, confused floodwaters, we hear that, that this is a destruction that is associated with Shaul and with Sheol and with Babylon.
Yeah.
It's very hard to miss the connection of these six words and Yeshaya 17 and this whole prophetic indictment has been against Babylon.
Well, that's what hit me when you were reading it. I'm thinking, you know, if I was trying to claim this is not what we're saying or what you're saying, is what do I do with that? I mean, you've got
to do with that.
You know, because he's already told you in the other prophecy that they're coming across in waves, and you know, and he's talking about the sea of people just flooding in. So what do you do? What else? Oh, where would you go with it? Where else could you go?
You know, I've been saying for a long time that the most adroit fit for Babylon is the Roman Catholic Church or for Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's Babel is Bible, means with the Lord. It's a religion conceived by commingling truth and lies. And I remember writing, and I didn't come across it here as we were talking, but I remember writing that, you know, Let's say I'm wrong. Let's say I'm wrong.
Okay.
Then why don't you come up with a more adroit fit that also encompasses so many people that it justifies this much, this many words in the midst of the most important prophecies of the last days ever issued.
Ever. Of course.
So if there's something that is as popular as Christianity, particularly, that is as associated, integrated into every clue that we have about Babel and Babylon.
Right.
Then tell me what it is.
Yeah, I totally agree.
You know, there are, and I think it's fair to say that there are some places where, particularly in Revelation, and it's reinforced in other places in Yirmiyah, where, you know, how Yirmiyah goes from this whole explanation of the American stupidity of creating a war in Syria, and how the Damascus falls, and then Israel is then at the waist, and harvests his covenant children, and then the Muslims flood into Israel at a level that can't be stopped, and we have that whole sequence of events in the in the last days, and we have this statement mirroring and being right on top of it.
Yeah.
So, in those last days, what organization that models all of the issues that God has brought up and the concerns about Babel, that what religious institution is still standing that's as influential as Christianity?
There isn't any.
Not even close.
No.
So, first of all, I don't know how you disassociate Christianity. Now, there is one, and this is one point I want to get at. There is one reference, particularly as God is talking about the merchants and Yirmiyah, all the great merchants weep at her destruction and the great city that is destroyed. You know, America is responsible for the merchant trading of the world, and the great city that would be America would be New York, which is the financial capital of the world. And so there are some references, both in Yirmiyah and also in Revelation, that would say Babylon represents the United States. And I would say that nationally, that's probably true.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the national representation is nearly as important as the religious implication, because God is primarily drilling down on religious implications, both seem to fit.
Yeah. But we're always touting ourselves as the great Christian nation. Spreading
right.
Democracy, on and on and on, from democracy to Christianity.
Yeah, if you go back even 15 years, about 80% of Americans would identify themselves as Christians.
Yeah.
Yeah, so America views itself as a Christian nation. And it's a hugely Catholic nation as well.
Oh, yeah. So that's commingled, if you like.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess the most commingled of all nations. So if it commingling means the definition of Babel, a nation with a Babel belt.
Babel
is America.
Through the south, yeah. All the way through Texas and all.
Yeah. For indeed.
Belial. You know, when you got Babel, and then you got a Belial, and then you go to Belial, and it says fodder for wild animals, birds, and insects. So if you extrapolate a minute, that this confusion mixed crap that you're doing and worshiping Baal is going to wind up, as we'll find out, is they're all going to die. But then you'll just be fodder for the wild animals and the birds and the insects. I know it's not very difficult. It's just when you start looking at all these things, the principles, you go, my gosh, there's nowhere you can turn when he's not painting a picture. It's just
correct.
Yeah. Sorry for that.
For indeed, devastating destruction, annihilation, and obliteration has come upon Babel. And her elitists are mighty and powerful, her influential religiously and politically, along with her military and her most prominent individuals and civic leaders, will be caught, captured, and incarcerated. And their cruel weapons will be shattered and destroyed because Yahweh of retribution and recompense. He will absolutely and unequivocally fulfill his promise to hold them accountable as a consequence and penalty for what they have done. When Babylon took Jerusalem and hauled Israelites, Yehudim, off into captivity, whose idea was that?
Well, Yahweh allowed it to happen because it turned out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I told him it was going to happen.
That I
allowed
it to happen anymore. You want him? Go,
yep.
Go live.
We allowed it to happen. And, and the Babylonians released the Yehudim, too, didn't they? I mean, the real difference is there are some people that Yahweh said, listen, my people need a timeout. I'm just going to allow these people to give them a timeout. And some of the times those people, like the Assyrians, they take it too far. I mean, putting rings in their noses and chains in the rings and dragging them naked across the desert. The Assyrians took it way too far. And the Assyrians essentially either assimilated or murdered, enslaved the Jews. And there isn't a time where we read about the 10 tribes of Israel being granted a return from Assyria, do we?
No.
But that's not the case with Babylon.
No, they go
Babylon back. Was specifically established, authorized, if you will, to give Israel this time out. To give them, they weren't celebrating the Shabbat. He gave them 70 Shabbats. And then, Yahweh had one of the most sweeping prophecies in the history of humankind. The Daniel prophecies revealed right there.
Mm-hmm.
And they allowed his people to come back home. In fact, they were better about it than the Egyptians ever dreamed about being.
Mm-hmm.
So for Yahweh to say, I'm going to pound the living daylights out of Babylon. When I was the one that authorized what they did, and they even released my people and gave them, many of the artifacts of the temple to take back with them.
Yes, so they could rebuild the temple.
Yeah.
That's the whole story, yeah.
So why would he be so upset about Babylon if that's all that he had against them? Why would he be ranting about Imperial Rome that sacked Jerusalem twice, that destroyed the temple.
The temple.
They turned the temple into the Roman Colosseum.
Good point.
And you tell me that. And the answer is that he's not talking about the kingdom of Babylon.
Old Babylon. No. Not talking about old Babylon.
Right. And the timing of this is last days. So it's what Babylon inspired. It's why when Daniel is given the insights into the migration of the beast, and he starts with, the first beast is Babylon. It's the mother of harlots.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is Media Persia. Mm-hmm. And the third is that after Persia conquered Babylon, we all know the story of Alexander the Not So Great, and how he was obsessed with Darius and finally beat Darius and the Greeks prevailed over Babylon, over Persia.
Yes.
And then the most vicious small beast would come next.
Yes, the Romans.
Rome. And the Romans conquered the Greeks. And they were the most vicious of all human civilizations. But then he talks about what would grow out of that beast. That's the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah, that commingling stuff, too.
Yeah. And the Roman Catholic Church commingled the Babylonian religion, the Greek religion. Boy, do they have a lot of Greek religion.
Mm-hmm.
And the Roman religion. All commingled. And a lot of Roman politics. Even the Roman language. Even the Roman geography. Even the Roman city. Even the Roman name. In fact, it's the book that has the most to do with the establishment of the Christian religion. It's called Romans.
That's his opus. Yeah, that's his masterpiece.
That's
his masterpiece. Yeah.
Of course. Yes. The basis of the Christianity. Book of Romans. For indeed, devastating destruction and annihilation. Obliteration. You know that the city of Babylon continued well past 500 BCE, past 400. Yeah. You know, when Alexander the Great went there, where did Alexander hang out and ultimately die? The guy could go anywhere. I mean, he'd conquered the known world.
Was it in Babylon? I thought it was in
Babylon. Absolutely.
It
was in Babylon.
Okay.
No, Babylon as a city was not obliterated. And Babylon continued to be an inhabited city all the way through sometime around 50 CE. Finally swallowed up in the sands of time. So what God is talking about here didn't happen then, but will happen now. Devastating destruction and annihilation, total and complete obliteration, extermination and extinction of it, eradication. By the way, it's the word here, shadad. The feminine, it's shada, is a concubine in a polygamous relationship as part of a harem. Yeah, she's the mother of all whores, mother of whores, has come upon Babel and her elitists, her mighty and powerful, her influential and politically, religiously influential, along with her military and most prominent individuals and civic leaders, will be caught, captured, and incarcerated. You know, the last thing that the Persians needed was to incarcerate Babylon's civic leaders, military leaders, influential people. They had plenty of slaves. They didn't need more slaves. The last place they were going to go for slaves was Babylon. And the last people you'd want as slaves are religious and political leaders and military leaders. Military leaders are too prone to rebel. And religious political leaders aren't worth it.
You don't want to educate slavery either. Slaves either.
Right. And they're just not worth it. They don't do anything. They're not. You want slaves to cook your meals, to clean your house, to farm your fields. They're useless. They didn't incarcerate those people.
No.
But Yahweh was going to.
Yeah.
Because it's the leaders that are going to be incarcerated. The most prominent religious and political and military leaders are the ones, the civic leaders, that Yahweh is going to incarcerate. And he's going to catch them, capture them, and incarcerate them.
Now, Craig, this is a much bigger list of people that will go to Sheol than we normally think about. You know, we think about the popes and cardinals and the, you know.
But there's some Kirk that I've come upon. They're speaking of those in the last days that are going to be incarcerated and sent off to Sheol. And it's like 10 Hebrew words long, and each one of the Hebrew words is worth 10 English words.
Well, I mean,
and it's this on steroids.
Yeah. Wow.
But this is a comprehensive list. They're going to be caught. They're going to be captured. They're going to be incarcerated, along with their cruel weapons. You know, the Babylonian weapons weren't significantly better than the Assyrians. They weren't significantly better than the Egyptians or the Hittites.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
They most certainly weren't up to the challenge of the Greeks.
Well, the Greeks had strategy better than they had weapons. The Romans came along, and boy, they had real weapons. I mean, they had a machine, basically, and they could engineers and all kind of stuff. Yeah.
The cruel weapons, the cruelest weapons. Wait a minute, this is cruel. Harsh, cruel. Cruelest weapons of all time. The weapons of Roman Catholicism. Now, people don't think of that because they don't think of Roman Catholicism really having an army. But the cruelest weapons ever used against humanity were those deployed by the Roman Catholic Church to torture those that wouldn't submit. That anybody who was deemed a threat to their lives, that we could expose them, was tortured using the most cruel devices ever conceived by man. There's no institution in human history that has built a wider array or used a wider array of cruel devices than the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah, that's saying something.
That's saying something, but that is absolutely indisputable. There is no nation in the history of humankind, no institution in the history of humankind that even comes close. And when you look at the history of torture, it's like 90% of the torture devices are Roman Catholic. I mean, the only thing that they can't take credit for is cattle prods. They had goats, but they didn't have cattle prods because they're electrified. You know, shock treatment because they didn't have electricity.
Yeah.
And waterboarding. But all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Roman Catholic. And most of the Roman Catholic torture devices were also designed to be used by sexual perverts and psychopaths. That were specifically designed to torment men in their genitals and women in the same place. And so if you're a Roman Catholic today, you're either an absolute ignoramus or you have no capacity to exercise judgment. To believe that an institution that created the most wicked torture devices in human history and deployed them with reckless abandon
to protect themselves and their lives
is godly. Or that the institution that has committed more acts of pedophilia than any other institution in human history, maybe more than all other institutions combined, is representing God. And you're just stupid. And beyond the fact that 90% of what Roman Catholicism professes is Babylonian.
What a legacy. God.
Oh, it's disgusting. Man, it's no wonder God is saying, finally, indeed, devastating annihilation, total obliteration upon Babylon. Roman Catholicism and Christianity. And her elitists, her mighty and powerful, her influential religiously and politically, along with her military, her most prominent individuals and civic leaders. They're going to be caught, they're going to be captured, they're going to be incarcerated, along with their cruel weapons. You know, today, the cruelest weapon maker is not the Roman Catholic Church. What do you think makes the cruelest weapons today?
Yeah, we make some awful bad weapons.
Yeah, the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So today it would be us. We're the merchants of death.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. They'll be shattered and destroyed, says Yahweh, the God of retribution and recompense. Now, that is so different. You know, the Christian church has all these images of the Lord Jesus with the Roman nose and the blue eyes and the pretty little robes with the hands off to the side. And the pretty little feet, and he's floating down out of the clouds with a big smile, and all the little children are going to gather unto him. Well, I want to say that bullcrap.
No,
that ain't the way it's going to happen.
Yeah.
God's going to destroy every religious person on earth, obliterate them. Every religious institution, every religious building, every religious artifact, every military, every political party, all gone. And it's going to be instantaneous and pervasive. He's coming back as Yahweh of retribution and recompense. He's going to hold people accountable. And it has to be that way. You know, every time we hear about somebody who tragically lost a loved one because a drunk driver hit them, because some indiscriminate moron decided to commit an act of mass murder or whatever it may be. The family doesn't have closure until the perpetrator is caught. Until you can hold the perpetrator accountable, there's no closure. There's no peace. You can't put it behind you. And if the perpetrator never is held accountable, then there's a system of no justice. God is not going to be that way. He's going to make certain that those who have done these heinous things are held accountable. And he is going to assure those who survive them that those who oppressed them, subjugated them, killed them, misled them, are being tried and convicted, and that they will be incarcerated as a consequence for what they have done. It is the right and moral thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Yahweh is going to absolutely and unequivocally fulfill his promises to hold them accountable as a consequence and penalty for what they have done. It is fair. It is right. A God coming back that's peaches and cream.
Yeah.
Isn't fair.
Forgive this. You can't forgive these things. He said he wouldn't.
No.
He's going to spell this a stone. He said, I'm not going to forgive this.
No. If he did, then heaven and eternity would be just like the worst that we experience here on earth.
Right all over. On steroids.
Yeah, man would have an eternity to act badly. It's not what God wants. And he says, I shall see to it. Now, this list,
this is
the long one here, my friend. This is the one you're talking about.
Yes, sir.
And I shall see to it that her commanders, captains, and military officers, her government leaders, and her religious officials, czar. Now, that's the people that most of us on earth hold, not I shouldn't say us, but most people hold in highest esteem.
Respect
commanders, that. Captains, military officers, government leaders, and religious officials. I shall see to it that her commanders, captains, military officers, and governmental leaders, and religious officials, her scholars, theologians, and shrewd men, her governors, administrative officials, and those who seek to be esteemed and respected, as well as those who rule by fear, her heads of government, and her senior military officers, both civilian and royal rulers, and her most powerful and influential, her most valiant soldiers, military heroes, and community leaders, shall drink their fill, becoming incapacitated. And so they will become chronically inactive and debilitated in an altered state of awareness forever.
And
they will not be revived.
Mm-hmm.
Prophetically declares Yahweh, the one in charge, whose personal and proper name is Yahweh, of the vast array of heavenly messengers and spiritual implements. Wow, there's so much here. First,
wow,
the list of who is going to be incarcerated is long, and it includes every civic, religious, political, military, an academic leader.
It's even religious artists. You left out the craftsmen. These are the people.
Yeah, oh, I did, didn't I? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just registered with me, you know. Don't do that, artist.
No, it depends on what you're, of course, building as the craftsman and the
These are the people who make the statues. Somebody's making them for those things. Somebody's making all those crosses. that they're hanging up, and that's there are people in business doing that, religious art. And
yeah. But think about the penalty here. There's no torture in hell. But think of what would be more anguishing. You know, I've thought about would I want to continue to live if I was a quadriplegic.
Yes. No, you wouldn't. And, yes,
I don't think so. Because I couldn't write. It'd be very difficult. You know, studying Yah's testimony, while it's gratifying, it's the ability to make all these connections. It's really fun. But what makes it satisfying is being able to share it.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't do it.
No, just get you through the day.
And now, to imagine being essentially a quadriplegic forever. One of the, maybe it's almost a blessing. You know, it's happened to so many people that I know that if you're a quadriplegic, you're not going to live very long. You know, so you don't have to endure that state for a long time. Now, I understand there's a lot of people that are quadriplegics that are living fulfilling lives, and you know, I'm not wishing anything. I'm not trying to be pejorative here, but what God is talking about is a person being unable to move.
Mm-hmm.
And yet existing in that state forever.
Yeah.
Your conscience. Yeah, you're conscious, you're aware, and yet you can't move.
And there's no hope of escape.
No.
This is not going to happen.
Oh, wow.
They will not
and, be you know, if you're in a dark cave with no light,
mm-hmm.
you know, you'd go blind. And this is a place of utter darkness. So you're totally blind, and you cannot move. And you're that way forever. That's the risk you take if you're a theologian. If you're an officer in the military. If you're a politician.
Sobering,
that's the risk you're taking. Because God says, there's going to come a day where I'm going to incapacitate them all such that they will never be revived. And oh, by the way, if you want a hint as to why they're on this list, he is reminding all of us, oh, by the way, this is being done by Yahweh. They all think that they're in charge. They're in charge of their church. You know, the Pope is in charge of his church. The president's in charge of America. The general's in charge of the army. The theologian is in charge of the seminary. The professor is in charge of the university. He's in, I'm the one who's in charge. Trust me on this. I'm the one who's in charge. And my name is Yahweh.
This is a great line.
My name is Yahweh. Don't forget it. Now that's one thing. You're going to be frozen, unable to move, blind forever. But I want to leave you this one thought. My name is Yahweh. And I'm the one in charge. Now, he is not telling that to his children. Why isn't he telling his children, my name is Yahweh and I'm the one in charge?
Yeah, we know his name.
Because we all know his name. And that's not the role that he wants to play with his children.
No, his father, of course.
Yeah. But these guys and gals that thought that they were in charge said, no. I'm the one who's in charge. And my name is Yahweh. Therefore, thus affirms Yahweh of the vast array of heavenly messengers and spiritual implements, the Saba. The wide and spacious surroundings, serving as a means to join in, to fortify, to protect, and enclose. Of Babylon, of those creating confusion by combining and commingling to confound. Shall be stripped away and completely exposed.
Right.
Then her haughty and improper, disgusting public median areas, esteemed but horrid residences, vile temples, offensive gateways, and tempestuous marketplaces shall be set ablaze and burned with fire. As a result of the people's labor, will be for absolutely nothing. Wholly insufficient for having chased worthless fantasies and delusions. Therefore, the archaic people of these nations who are massing under an antiquated and unifying religious and or political leader will go into the fire. They will be trifled with and seen as worthless because it is deserved and necessary as they fall and are destroyed. Well, we came across Laom, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
But, and we had Laom directly associated with Babel, didn't we? Babylon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Remember how, I don't know if you remember this or not, but when we started observations for a time, we started in Proverbs 6, and it was talking about the influence of Pauline Christianity. I said, you know, what I think I want to do is after we get through this section of the Proverbs, because it was talking about the whores and the influence of religion and the like, and satanic influence in religion. And so wouldn't it be interesting, because we all know that Hasatan is introduced to us in association with Babylon. And hear me out, I think it's like 14. We all know it's there. Why don't we just dig into Yirmiyahu right from the beginning? Let's go all the way through, at least that far, so that we can tie in all of these references: the whore, the Babylon, Satan, religion. And let's see if God will bring it all together for us. And the only thing that up to this point we didn't have nailed down was Babylon. Well, that has sure been solved, hasn't it? This is all about Babylon.
Yes.
Therefore, thus affirms Yahweh, the wide and spacious surrounding, serving as a means to join in. That's the broad and wide path to death and destruction. The way in opposition to the Torah, the way of religion, the popular way of Babel, of Babylon, of Christianity in particular, Roman Catholicism, shall be stripped away and completely exposed. And that's something that for God to be just, for there to be closure on this, for people to understand, why am I doing this? Yahweh has to explain that this is the plague of death. That I'm going to establish my home for 1,000 years here on earth, and the thing I need to do to keep my family safe is to rid my home of this plague of death. And so he's going to expose it as the plague of death before he rids the world of it, so that those who are being incarcerated will know why they're incarcerated, which is fair. And those who survive, rather than look at, well, wow, you were pretty mean there, they're going to say,
they'll know exactly why it's all happening. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what he's telling us here. I'm going to expose it. I'm going to explain exactly, strip away all the religious pretense of the lies, so that you understand why I have to rid my home of these people in this institution. So, and here, you know, God is making it very clear. This is Laom. These are people who are transformed under a single religious and political leader, who are adherents of an antiquated philosophy. Right? How could you have a more antiquated philosophy in Christianity than that of Babylon? That's about as antiquated as it gets, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right back to the very source.
Right.
It really is. I mean, it's just...
Mm-hmm. And that's what Leon means. It means that people are congregate under a religious or political leader using an antiquated system. Well, there is no more antiquated system than the system of Babylon. That's why it's the mother of the beasts. What? It's the wellspring from which all these beasts flow. It's the most antiquated thing. The first civilization that Yahweh talks about is ancient Babylon.
It hasn't changed an iota.
Right. Right. It is the most antiquated. And Laom, that's the thing that strikes more than anything else, is Laom is as people congregating together under a religious or political leader using an antiquated system.
What is it in the collective brain of people that this doesn't resonate, that that's what it is?
Well, I think part of it is that...
Is an Islam that bad?
To get there, you have to have a real thirst to know.
Well,
because, if you just use the lexicons, you'll see archaic. I don't even think... I think if I were to say the word archaic, probably 3 out of every 4 people wouldn't even know what the word means unless I'd use it in a context that would define the word. I don't think they would know what it means.
Mm.
And so, one of the lexicons points out, yeah, it means archaic. Yeah, it means... Another one says, it means people congregating together. Yeah, it means people assembling under a singular religious or political leader. And so each just kind of adds a little bit to it, but the only way you really get it defined is you got to go back and see how Yahweh uses it. It's only used 20 times. It's not that hard to do. So I think part of it is it just comes back to the same thing, Kirk, that we've said for so long.
Uh-huh.
We're not special. You may be, but I'm sure heck not.
No, believe me. And after reading that last page, I'm delighted that I'm nobody.
Yeah, that's true. That's also true. But what we have, and I think you have it as much as anybody I've ever known, you have the want to.
Well, I do have the want to. I'll give myself credit.
Yeah. Right, we have the want to. And the answer to the question is you have to have the want to. And the want to is more than just investing the time. It's a willingness to go where the words lead.
Yeah, it seems like everyone I've talked to of late has grabbed hold of what we talked about and what Yahweh said, and they'll tell me it makes sense. Oh, gosh, that's really clear, and da-da-da. And then something, I guess they have to share it with somebody before they've studied or done the homework, and then they go, it just won't be brought up again. It's like I'm a plague for having brought that up, so I just don't pursue it. I bet with them after that. There's nothing I can do.
Yeah, I would say that is at least 80% of the people that I talk to are just, they say, that really resonates with me. That's exactly what I would expect. That is so fascinating. I can't wait to learn more about that. And you share it with them, you even give them one of the books.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask them to, if any questions, talk about it.
Yeah.
And you don't hear from them again.
Yeah.
But I will also say, for example, this week, I got 4 letters this week from people that I have never heard of from ever. But, we were talking where Jackie and some others said, I think you're way too optimistic when you're saying that 7,000 people are going to be harvested. And that's based upon the group that we know, it's 700 is more likely. Well, that's 3 people. That may not sound by much, but there are 4 people.
Like a lot to me.
But in 1 week of people that had not made contact with any of us any other place, and they've read all the books.
Wow.
They write in a manner that is obvious that they know who Yahweh is, that they've left religion and politics, that they're celebrating the Mikra, that they're part of the covenant, and they're making really just outstanding conclusions. And And they're coming from all countries, all walks of life.
Wow. Isn't that marvelous?
So, wow. We may say, all right, just like you say, that you have a lot of people that seem interested and then they fade off into oblivion.
Yeah.
That's still lots of people. And
yeah.
By lots of people. All we're talking about is one in a billion.
I know.
You know, 7,000 amongst 7 billion would be the one in a million that Yahweh has always used as barometer. And so I think it is. I think those are the numbers. And I'm really good with those numbers. You know, I think that creates a very rich array of people for us to spend eternity with. I used to be a real introvert, such that you put me in a crowd of people, you put me in more than three or four people, and, you know, I clammed up. I just froze. And it just was so draining for me. And then I willed myself out of being shy, because I thought being shy was so debilitating. But I would tell you still, if you put me in a grand ballroom with 1,000 people that I don't know, I'm going to be drained. In 5 minutes there, my skin's going to be crawling. I'm going to want to get out of there. I'm not energized by it. I'm debilitated by it. And so being in eternity with this mass of the people that you don't know, I'm not sure that would be family. It's thousands of people, that works.
Yeah.
That's a goodly number. Keeps it interesting. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we're going to want to do in small groups anyway.
That's true. I mean, always a small cocktail party is a lot more fun, or a few people over for, or even an extra, just someone else coming over, you know, to talk about stuff is always great.
Yeah.
It's comfortable for everybody gets a voice, everybody gets in, we can talk better.
Yeah. The place, though, that really was profound for me was in this past month or so, when the net came back up again, and we were dealing with the Yeshaya 18, and here's the neck, and it's right in the middle of a declaration where God's calling His people out of America. And then I'm motivated to say, okay, what is the neck? And I find out that in a Mizmor, you've got Dode telling people about the neck, and he's in first person saying, please respond to me.
Mm-hmm.
And now you say, okay, it's in America. That's where God's calling His people home. That's where He's raising this neck. And this neck is not only designed primarily to reach out to the children of Israel. That's its priority. That's the people it's trying to reach. But it's conveying Dode's sentiments, his words uniquely. And when you put all that together, I don't know how you'd, where you look apart from what we're doing here.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm totally in agreement there. I don't think anybody can argue that.
I would love to argue with it. Wouldn't it be wonderful if there's some place out there that somebody is going beyond what we're doing?
And
is creating a much better translation and a much better focus on Dode's life and speaking more effectively to Israel. Wouldn't that be great? I'd celebrate it.
Yeah.
I'd go off and take a cruise to the Bahamas and not get out of my swim trunks for a month. I'd be the happiest dude in the world. I mean, I'd go crazy and I'd probably take my computer and translate another book while I was doing it, just because it's so much fun. But wouldn't that be a thrill?
Yeah, that'd be funny.
But I used to. You know, I look at the books that we've written and the things that we've done, and you realize that this has been pretty much 6 days a week for the past 17 or 18 years. And it actually began where it had to begin. It didn't begin with the Torah. It began with Islam. the most menacing force that that humanity has ever known. And the, these last days are just absolutely rife with the consequence of Islam. And then it goes through a book called Questioning Paul that destroys the myth of Christianity, the world's most popular religion, and then speaks of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and particularly Dode's view on them. And you say, all right, well, that's been 6 days a week for 18 years. How long do we have left?
Yeah.
So if there ain't somebody that's at least, and we're not even close to being done, I know how long it takes.
Yeah.
I just don't see it. I would love for it to be that way, but I just don't see it.
Yeah, I know. We talked about that for the first time. We're talking about Nick.
Yeah.
Who else? I mean,
it also was trying to drill down onto this week, because I was just writing and I got the almost like cold chills.
Really?
And I heard this voice that said, "Do you ever wonder why I only gave one name of the people who are going to speak on my behalf? There's two messengers, two witnesses at the last day. You ever wonder why I only gave one name?"
No.
Yeah, I said so. Who else is out there that's willing, prepared to speak to against Christianity and Islam, as well as rabbinic Judaism? That can talk about my Beret covenant and message. I'm going to have Elijah there.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to speak to my people. That's who I'm most interested in. But we need some crazy goyim out there that is going to refute the rest of the world. You know, we've always thought it would be Enoch, but why? Just because he was, and then God took him.
Well, yeah.
We don't know anything about Enoch. What does Enoch know about Islam and Christianity? What does Elijah know about Islam and Christianity?
Yeah.
You know, God chose Moshe to go into Egypt because he knew about Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, no question. He's the perfect candidate.
Yeah, so it was a sober moment. I don't know if what beyond just food for thought that was, but it was a rather sober moment. I think I'm about the only person out there that would actually prefer to stay to the bitter end. And my desire to stay to the bitter end, I mean, well, if I had my druthers, I'd like to be part of the true harvest and have some really, really spectacular outings and fun and some adventures in the universe and then be brought back. Wouldn't that be cool?
Absolutely.
And because I would like to give them both barrels. The world's leaders, the world's militaries, the shatters of myths.
Wow.
So, I'll tell you one thing. You want to be prepared for it? Well, I wouldn't do it for you because you married well. But get a divorce from a woman that wants to abuse you in every possible way and demean you. Boy, I'll tell you what, that'll prepare you.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you'll learn how to deal with unending, ruthless, devious, delusional attacks, paranoid attacks, without getting angry. And that's really what you have to do. You know, the righteous indignation is such that you're disgusted, but you're never out of control. You know, and I think that there's been a lot of preparation for that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm only going to do it if I get to take my my four-footed friend with me.
Yeah, let's ask her what she thinks about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, bud.
Yeah. Right now on the floor saying this has been a really good show. Now, we go and have something more to eat.
Yeah, I don't want a cookie.
Okay. Anyway, well, you know, one of the things though, I just wanted to find that last thought because you know it's been fun being a goyim calling Yehudim home.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know Yahweh says I'm going to blind them, and you know they're going to read and not see, they're going to hear and you know or listen and not hear, and you know because of the it's just what they've chosen to do, and it's with the attitude that that particularly rabbis have and the religious Jewish community towards the Gentiles. It's kind of fun. But you know, clearly Yahweh is not going to have a prophet that's a Gentile.
Yeah,
so one of two things would have to be considered. One is, I'm not sure there's any prophecy that the witnesses, I just think the witnesses are there to say, this is what Yahweh said, this is what man says. You can choose between the two, but make no mistake, this is what God says. And what man is saying is stupid. That's basically the job, right?
Yeah.
You're not, at that point, there's no need to say, oh, by the way, the institutions of man are going to lose in the end. God's going to have a 1,000-year celebration. So, if you don't know that, tell on somebody. That's not, and even that has already been revealed. So you're not being a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think there's any prophecy as part of it.
No, there isn't.
No.
No, it's just. He's just representing Yahweh. Well, yes,
right. And the other thing, and the other thought that I had is, because this was really a really unique moment,
uh-huh.
is that I had this thought of, say, all right, so it's been fun being a goyim, lifting up this neck in America. But if we all get harvested, and then one or more of us has the opportunity to come back and be one of the two witnesses. When we were coming down as essentially as a spiritual being,
mm-hmm.
right?
All right.
Well, at that point, post Bukurim and Shabuah.
Yeah, that's you're totally.
How is there any distinction at that point? Yeah, how is there any distinction at that point? And the birth family between
there's not supposed to be any.
I don't think there is any at that point.
No.
So that point really doesn't matter. I don't think that that Eliyah's ethnicity matters one iota when he comes back.
Hardly. Hey, well, you're either a spiritual being or you're not. Once you are, you are. You're related to Yah.
And I can guarantee that right now Enoch is a spiritual being because he cannot be in heaven without being a spiritual being.
That's right.
So he's a spiritual being.
Yeah.
So he's only going to come back as with a physical nature in the E equals MZ squared view that a tiny, tiny, tiny portion of who he has become could animate a physical body.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what you need if you're going to be able to speak every language and speak to everyone in the world simultaneously in terms of answering arguments. That's kind of what you need. But at that point, ethnicity doesn't seem to be a big deal. I think ethnicity will be a big deal as Israel is repopulated with Yehudim and Israelites. But apart from that, I don't think it matters.
Wow. No fault with that.
It can't be Dode. You know, Dode would be the coolest dude of all to come back would be Dode, but it can't be Dode. Dode's got a job.
No.
And it can't be Moshe. He wasn't allowed into the promised land. It ain't going to be Moshe. No.
Wow.
I'm going to tell you, the guy that I really, really like, come to really, really like, is Elisha. It's Yah and Yasha Elsh. Yahweh, our God of salvation. That guy's got an attitude. He is smart, dude. Some of his statements are just are ballsy and courageous and brilliant. So,
give me a little verse on what you're working on so I can sneak ahead a little bit. And
I'll send it to you tomorrow where I am in my rewrite of the Moab chapter where the voice of the Torah died. Yeah, I will. I'll send that to you tomorrow because it's a significant rewrite of that chapter. And I think it took that chapter from a guy struggling to try to figure out why he goes from the chapters, which were the culmination of the work, which was to expose Satan's influence in religion, and all of a sudden you got two chapters just on Moab. And at its peak, Moab was nothing. It was a tiny little burg. And Moab isn't amongst the it wouldn't even make the top 500 civilizations. It was nothing. Never anything. And it existed for a very short period of time. So, trying to figure out why Moab, that was a tough write. And I think I didn't do as good a job as I should have done because I really wanted to get to Yeshaya 17 and 18. And so it's a good thing that I've gone back. And I had understated how in both Yeshaya and in Yirmiyah how big a role that Moab plays in last day prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
Just play almost as big a role as Babylon.
Yeah. Wow.
So it's incumbent upon us to have a really good understanding of what they represent. And what I'm finding is there's a significant overlap. So just as Babylon is religiously Roman Catholicism and nationally America, Moab, more than anything else, is Pauline Christianity, the rest of the Christian religion. But it's also multiculturalism, socialist secular humanism. You know, so it's a little more than just
straightforward.
It's kind of the trinity of the modern era. But God's depiction of these people and why, what they represent. I think he does a pretty good job of equipping us to make that determination. So I'll send it to you. I think you'll like it.
Last question I have before you head on back to Ashley.
Uh-huh.
In the end of this particular 17, you do a go through them all again on chapter 17, on verse 17, 1 and on through.
Uh-huh.
Is that where you want to go next? Is that where we want to start next week and do this again?
I think so. I mean,
you can skim it a little bit if you wish too, but I just didn't know whether I should do that or start studying 18 or more days.
I think so, probably, that it does a... the negative is it's a lot of reading because it requires a lot of very concise thoughts.
Yes.
But it probably is worth just, you know, here's the flow of history.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is really what that chapter does. It says, you know, this is, these are the events that are going to define the time of Jacob's trouble and what's going to happen.
Damascus, the story of Damascus is the one that's I've kept on my desk forever. That's what started all this, you know, when I told you when you were just starting to rewrite it. I didn't even know you were starting to rewrite that part, but I keep going to it and going to it just because of how important it is as the catalyst for all things.
And who would have thought that today, you know, here the Pope announces that he's going to Morocco for the express purpose of unifying Catholicism and Islam. So it is, you know, it's exactly what is being presented here.
Boy, it's a cold world. Well, this has been great.
Yep. All right, my friend. We will be with you again this time next week.
Yes, sir.
We'll be here for the lessons on Esau's wife.
Okay. Take care. Shalom,
all right.